It's good to be in church today, isn't it? The last Sunday of the year. And how was 2013 for you? Was it a good year? Raise your hand if it was a good year. Wow, this is great. How many of you are glad we're moving out of 2013? Raise your hand. Okay. Well, today and this week is a time of celebration, as we celebrated a few nights ago on Christmas Eve here, and in your own families you celebrated the birth of our Lord. But also it's a time to look back, and it's a time to look forward. And a lot of times it's a time to get a little depressed at what's going on in your life because you're taking an assessment. And I pray that this week and the next couple of weeks that you can look and see what God is really doing in your life. And if you do not believe in Him and you are not a believer and a Christian in understanding, that you can still see that God is working in your life, that God wants you to be drawn to Him. And if you are a believer, that He's doing so much in your life, even at the times when you can't see it. And so this next 5 or 6 weeks, we're going to look at the life of someone in the Old Testament whose life kind of goes like this. Does your life go like this sometimes? I mean, I wish it was all like this. I just wish tomorrow was better than today and next on Tuesday's better than Monday. But sometimes it goes up and down, right? And probably the most mercurial guy in the entire Bible is the man David. David is such a cool guy sometimes, and he's such a fiend other times. And we're going to look at that over the next few weeks. We're going to look at David and Goliath. We're going to look at David and Saul. We're going to look at David and Bathsheba. We're going to look at David and Nathan. We're looking at David and God. We're just going to look at David's life, the good, the bad, and the ugly of David, because I really think that he personifies many of our lives, the good, the great, the powerful, and then the times when we are weakest and what happens. And I want us to look at that. And today we're going to look at probably the most famous aspect of David's life, because it's one of the early ones, and that is David and Goliath. And if you have your Bibles, turn to 1 Samuel chapter 17. Not a part of the Bible we go to a lot, but 1 Samuel 17. And we'll be looking at that in a moment. I'm going to give some introductory thoughts on that. So when you find it, just open it up. And there's a place on the back of the bulletin for some notes if you'd like to take it. I'm going to introduce this because I think it's important to really get a sense of this story, because this story is so... It's like the most famous story of the Old Testament, right? We describe the underdog and the giant, David and Goliath, in our lives. And, you know, today in a football game, someone's going to say they're the Davids and the others are the Goliaths. And we sometimes totally miss the whole story. And today I want us to look at the real aspect of the story of David and Goliath. We know it so well. We know the stones. We know the brook. We know the giant. We know the sling. We know the Philistines. But do we really know the story? And I'm praying that by the end, as we leave here in a few moments, that you really understand the breadth of this story. So let me begin with us understanding what a word means. The word is truce. A truce. A truce is not a treaty, it's not peace, but it's an agreement between two parties that there should be some peace for a time, that we're going to cease fighting for a little bit of time. 99 years ago this week, there was the most famous truce of the early 20th century. World War I was fighting and raging. It was December 24th, 1914, and everybody was fed up with this war. The English and the Allies, the French, some Americans were in trenches on this side. The Germans were on trenches on this side. It was a nasty war. My grandfather fought in this war and described just some of the most heinous things, like mustard gas and all these things. And it was Christmas Eve. And they agreed to have a truce for a period of time, about 4 hours. And the Americans and the British, more British and French, came out. The Germans came out, and they came into no man's land. They played soccer. They sang Christmas carols. They traded photographs of their children. They traded candy and cigarettes. Back then, everybody was smokers. They were trading all this thing, and they were just being what men like to be and just talking. And then 4 hours later, they got back into their holes and fought the most ugly war of years. But it was for 4 hours. A few years later, there's a great story that most people don't know, but it was in the land of Palestine, just before World War II, before the land became known as Israel. The Zionists were coming in, and the Muslims, or they might be, have been called Palestinians back then, were fighting these little battles. And there was a Christian group in Jerusalem. This is about 19 in the 30s. There was a Christian group there called the American Colony. There's a hotel there now in the north side of Jerusalem, just outside the walls. But it was a farm, and it was a hospital and a hostel. And there was fighting going on around the other side of the city. And Jerusalem, the old city, is a mile square. Mile by a mile by a mile. They were a mile north, and a gentleman in the colony died, and he wanted to be buried on the Mount of Olives. Well, the Mount of Olives is on the east side of town where the fighting was going on. And so the head of this colony was a lady. Her name was Bertha Spafford. You may know her because her husband wrote that great song, Horatio Spafford, "It Is Well With My Soul." And she called up the leader of the Palestinians and said, "We want to do a funeral on the Mount of Olives, will you stop fighting for 4 hours? And she called up the head of the Zionists, and she said, "We want to do a funeral on Mount of Olives, will you stop fighting?" And they both agreed to a truce. And for 4 hours, back then they didn't have a lot of cars, so they walked with a caisson, two horses drawing the casket, and they all walked and did a processional on the outside of the walls of Jerusalem, went to the Mount of Olives, had the funeral, came back, and the war began again. It was a truce. It was just a negotiated time. In more modern times, just a few months ago, we celebrated the 50th anniversary of Martin Luther King's great speech, right? I Have a Dream. Well, Martin Luther King was a part of the civil rights movement in the South. Many of you who come from other countries aren't aware that there was a huge civil war, not the big civil war of the 1860s, but a civil rights movement in the 1960s that was being fought by protests and different things in the South. And Martin Luther King was not the only head, but he's kind of the figurehead of that movement. And he was in Albany, Georgia, early on, before Montgomery, before Birmingham, and all the famous scenes that we see there, and the tear gas and the fighting. And they were doing these protests, and he had a movement of people. And so he and the chief of police got to know each other very well. He was being thrown in jail, in and out of jail. The chief of police was a man named Pritchard. Actually, he was kind of for the movement. And he was very liked, and the two men got along, but one represented one side, one represented the other side. And they were sitting, getting ready to talk about the night's events and that there was going to be a big disturbance that night in downtown Albany, Georgia, back in the early 1960s. And all of a sudden, the secretary of the chief of police came in and handed him a telegram. Now, young people don't know what a telegram is, but it's a precursor to an email. And he brought a telegram, she brought a telegram in, and he read the telegram, and he began to weep. Martin Luther King said, "What's wrong?" He said, "It's from my wife." He says, "Anything wrong?" He goes, "No, she's just congratulating us on our anniversary, our 12th anniversary." He says, "Tell me about it." He said, "Well, I've been here for the last 3 weeks, sleeping on my couch, because you guys are having these protests every night, and I got to be downtown, and I can't be home." Martin Luther King said, "Let's call a truce." He said, "Tonight go home, have dinner with your wife, go out with her, and we'll resume the battle tomorrow morning at 10 a.m. It's an amazing story in the movement, but it's a truce. It was only lasted about 12 hours or 15 hours. There's a story in the Old Testament, this story of David and Goliath, where there was a truce. There were the Philistines who came from the coastal areas. There was the Israelites who came from the mountain areas or the hill countries. And they came into the middle area and they were set for battle, but they called a truce. And the reason they called a truce was because each knew the other could annihilate the other. I know that's bad English, but in other words, they just weren't sure who was going to win. And they knew if they went to battle, one of them was going to get annihilated. And why was that? Well, let me just give you the scene. The Philistines are coastal people. They lived where now is the Palestinian state of Gaza. You're familiar with the Gaza Strip? The Philistines lived along the Gaza Strip. There were five cities, Gath, Ekron, and three other cities. They were fortified. These were seafaring people. They came into that area, they fortified cities, and they needed land to start farming, to do vineyards, to do farming. And so they kept moving inland. You had the Israelites who were hill people. If you look at the Bible, most of the Bible is takes place about 40 miles inland, 30 to 40 miles inland, in the area known as Judea, which is Jerusalem and Bethlehem, Samaria, and then the Sea of Galilee, 30 to 40 miles inland. Not all of it is hill country, but all of it is inland. There's only a couple times in the Bible where they go to the coast. Jonah went to the coast, obviously. Paul went to the coast in Caesarea. There's a few times when they go to the coast, but most of the times they stayed inland in the hill countries and the valleys of the central part of what we now know as Israel and the West Bank. So the Philistines wanted to come in and take over the Israelites' land. The Israelites heard about it, and Saul the king came down out of the mountains to the middle area, that 15 or 20 miles area, from the coast to the hills. It was where the valleys and the hills are, one of the most beautiful parts of Israel. That's where the vineyards are. That's where the forests are. That's where some of the farms began to be. And they went to an area called the Shephelah. The Shephelah was the central part, not spoken a lot about in the Bible because, again, the Bible's more up in the hill country, right? But there's a couple things that occurred in the Shephelah. First of all, during the Crusades, that's where Saladin and the Crusaders had great battles. If you like the Crusades and like to read about the Crusades, if you're Jewish, you know about the Maccabean Wars. The Maccabean Wars fought between the Jewish Maccabees and the Syrians were fought in the Shephelah area. And then, of course, here is where the battle between the Philistines and the Israelites was, in the Shephelah. The north end of the Shephelah is more famous than the south end. The north end has a valley. Remember, there's hills and valleys and hills and valleys. The most famous valley in all of the Shephelah is the valley called Megiddo. Megiddo is known in the Old Testament, but it's more known in the book of Revelation because the hill, and in Hebrew, hill means is har, H-A-R. The H is silent in most in a lot of Jewish literature, so it's Armageddon, or in English, it's Armageddon. So the valley of Armageddon is in the north end of the Shephelah, and in the south end of the Shephelah is the valley of Elah. And the valley of Elah is where the Philistines came. They put themselves onto a hill, very much like the old westerns where the Indians were on one side and the, you know, the cowboys were on the other side, and there was this valley. At the bottom of the valley was a brook. Sometimes the brook was filled with water coming out of the mountains in the rainy season. Sometimes it was dry. Sometimes it just was babbling like a little creek. And I think that's what it was at this time, just a babbling creek between these two hills. These each hills were about 500 feet high, about a mile long. Thousands of men were assembled on each side for this battle. But here's the problem. And those of you who are in the army and infantry would know this, that you want to fight going down. You don't want to fight coming up. So if the Philistines came from the south, went down into the valley where the brook is and came up, the Israelites could have beaten them. If the Israelites came down and then came back up, the Philistines would have beaten them. So there was this truce, and it was a forced truce because no one wanted to do anything because they were afraid the other would defeat them. Both were too smart to go down to the valley and fight it on the valley floor. One was waiting for the other. The other was waiting for the other. See the scene? And this goes on day after day after day. And finally, the Philistines say enough. And they bring out their biggest guy. His name was Goliath. Now, depending on your translation, Goliath was either 6'9" or over 8 feet tall. He was truly a huge man. Many of you think I'm a big guy, but I am nothing compared to Goliath. Goliath probably weighed over 500 pounds. He had, it says, armor. This is the bronze era, so it's the armor was made of metal. His armor weighed approximately 125 pounds. That's on the front. Many times, you know, have you ever carried a sack? Some of you people have carried cement sacks, 50-pound sacks, 75 on the back. Sometimes you can carry 100 on your back. But this is on the front. 125 pounds, had a tunic. Then he had shin guards as well. His javelin or spear weighed over 15 pounds. 50. Can you imagine throwing 15 pounds? He could do it. He was there and he was a giant. So what they decided to do was to take a winner-take-all approach. So each morning for 40 days, Goliath would slowly walk down the hill, down towards that brook, down towards the valley. The valley is about 500 meters wide, and he would stand there and taunt the Israelites. Send your best man down, and let's fight one-on-one, and whoever wins, wins the entire battle. And the other will become the slaves to the victor. See the picture? And guess what the Israelites did every morning? Nothing. They were scared to death. So Saul, who was the king, by the way, Saul was a very tall man. Saul was like my size. So you have somebody like my size who is so afraid of Goliath that he says, I will give you great wealth. I will give you my daughter. And there's a part here that you miss if you don't read it well. He says, I will exempt your family from taxes for the rest of your life. Now, can you imagine that? Now, you got young people don't know what taxes are, but we do. We start doing our taxes here in a couple of weeks and realize that you would be exempt from national taxes for the rest of your life. And no one took it. Why? Because they saw this huge giant coming down the hill every morning taunting them. Come on down. And they wouldn't do it. That's the beginning and the place of the story. Now, into this story walks a boy named David. Now, we have all kinds of understanding of David because we have the entire Bible. But let me give you the understanding of David to this point. So pretend you know nothing about this guy, okay? You know nothing about David. You've never read Psalm 23. You don't know anything about David. David is first mentioned in 1 Samuel 16. We only know three things about David at this point. Number one, we know he comes from a family of eight boys, the son of Jesse, and actually out of the book of Ruth, you know his lineage. He's the great-grandson of Ruth and Boaz, but they don't even know that at this point. Jesse has eight sons. God tells Samuel, the high priest, who would be like the Supreme Court justice of Israel, that I don't like the king that we have. And the king is Saul, the first king of Israel. God doesn't like him. Saul has messed up. Saul is not God's man anymore. And God tells Samuel, go anoint one of the children of Jesse in Bethlehem, and I'll tell you who it is. So Samuel goes in 1 Samuel 16 to Bethlehem, and he finds out there are seven sons, he thinks. Seven sons. So he does this ornate worship center. He consecrates everybody, consecrates the home. He consecrates the family, consecrates the land. He gets a heifer. He does all this great thing. And then he says, bring your children to me. Now, Jesse had some fine children. The oldest three were all in the army. Eliab, Abinadab, and Shammah. They were great men. Strong, tall, big, well-built, well-structured, and in walks Eliab to Samuel. And you can just see the scene. He comes before him. You see this great, and Samuel kind of looks up, looks down, and goes, no. God told Samuel it was not this man. So he sees over here Abinadab, who's just as healthy and good. He goes, okay, Abinadab. Looks up, looks down, no. God's telling him, no. Then they bring Shammah, no. Then the unnamed son 4, the unnamed son 5, the unnamed son 6, the unnamed son 7. This took hours. No one was acceptable. And Samuel's like pulling his hair out. And he's going, God, Jesse, I see all the sons. And then Jesse goes, oh, yes, I have another son. Now, who thought he had eight sons? I mean, seven's enough, isn't it? He has eight sons. The youngest son is out taking care of the sheep. He's a shepherd boy. That's all we know about him. He's a shepherd boy. And Samuel says, I will not rest until I see this boy. Now, think about it. This is a little Bethlehem. There are no cars. There's no trucks. There's no phones. There's no texting. Someone had to go out and find him. Now, realizing that he's in the Judean hills somewhere, he could be 4 or 5 miles away. He could have gone south. He could have gone north today. They go wherever the grass is, right? So they had to go and hunt him down and find him. This took hours upon hours, and Samuel would not rest. He comes back in, and there's David. And God says, yes. And David is anointed. Puts oil on him, anoints him to be king. And then it's all over. It's like, you know, let me just pause for a minute. When you became a Christian, I talked to so many people who the build up to becoming a Christian is so great. And then all of a sudden you become a Christian and you go, well, what happened? That's kind of what is going on here. A great thing has happened, but it has paused. And we don't know much about David except this. All of a sudden, God begins to unfold David's life. See, it didn't happen the first day. It didn't even happen the second day. We're not even sure how many years has transpired. But David, the second thing we know about David is he was a musician. He was good with a harp, good with a lyre. He probably had some wind instruments he could play. And Saul was a very troubled man, Saul the king. And they called on musicians. And someone said, oh, David. Now, Saul knew nothing about this anointing. Saul calls on David, and David plays for him. Have you ever used music to soothe your soul? I got to tell you, if you have not, you've missed a great thing. Music is a great soother of the soul. I hope you use music and allow music. God has given us these creative arts to draw us up in majesty, but also to soothe our soul. And David could soothe the soul of Saul through this great music. And he did that. That's also in 1 Samuel 16. And then all of a sudden, the chapter ends. And the next chapter begins in 17 and says, now there were the Philistines. So all we really know about David at this point is that he's a shepherd boy, that he's been anointed, and that he's a good musician. We know nothing else about him. So chapter 17 opens up. It's a long chapter, so I won't read it till we get towards the end. And there he is. The battle is in a truce, kind of this forced detente. I won't kill you if you don't kill us. And this taunting of Goliath. Nobody knows this in Bethlehem. And the father, Jesse, sends David with food to the boys. Now, back then, they didn't have great supply lines. You wanted to eat. Your family brought you food. And so he puts together, we don't know if he had a donkey, if he put it on his back, but we know he had cheeses and breads and drink. And he takes it all to 15 miles to the west, to the Valley of Elah. He gets there. Now, 15 miles, think about it. I got runners here on the early front rows here. If he were running it, he couldn't run it because he had all this. It took a half a day, if not a whole day, to walk all the way up and down the hills to get there. He gets there, so I presume he spent the night outside. He's not afraid of the evening. Spends the night, gets there the next morning, and all this taunting is going on. The taunting. He knows nothing about it. So he goes to the commander who takes care of all the supplies, and he hands him the supplies. I can just see him handing him the donkey or handing him the big bushel and saying, you watch this. I want to go see what's going on. And he pulls his way through the crowd, through all the army, gets to the front. He's small, so he can kind of move through it all. And he goes, what's going on? And then he sees him, Goliath. He goes, what's this guy doing? He wants to fight one-on-one. And David says, well, who's going to do it? He doesn't realize there's been 39 other days, excuse me, of this. And he goes, who's going to do it? And he's looking around, who's going to do it? And nobody answers. And, you know, it's kind of like the cartoon where the little kid goes, I'll do it, I'll do it. And he goes, I'll do it. And his older brother, Eliab, who's already mad that he wasn't anointed by Samuel last year, says, get out of here, boy. What are you doing here? Get out of here. So David moves out, but he keeps talking. He's talking to everybody. Hey, what's going on here? What are you doing? And finally, some of the other people who didn't know David told Saul that there's this kid who says he'll go fight Goliath. So he comes in to Saul. Now, whether Saul recognized him as the musician or not is unknown. We don't know if Saul recognized him as the boy with the lyre and harp and the piccolo. We're not sure. But he goes, you want to fight this guy? And that's where we pick up the story. So let's just leave the story for a minute. Back in olden times, there were three ways to fight. And really, all the way up until most recently, three ways to fight. There was infantry fighting. The infantry was hand-to-hand combat. Throughout history, you see hand-to-hand combat. Different times it was with swords, different times it was with spears, different times it was with fists, but hand-to-hand combat. These two armies were infantry armies. Now, also at that time were also the cavalry. Cavalry were anyone who were on other things, like horses, chariots. In the desert, there'd be camels. Sometimes they were even on donkeys. If they were moving, mostly in horses, and we see that throughout history, right? That's the cavalry. We had them in the United States as well. They had them in World War I. We have them. That's the cavalry. The third was artillery. Artillery are the projectiles. In the olden days, there were two kinds of projectiles. Today, we have guns and machine guns and rockets and that. But back then, there were basically two kinds. One were the archers, and the other were the slingers. The slingers. Now, this is what's interesting. Slingers were people that used slings, obviously. Slinger, right? Now, you and I think of slings as when we grew up like wrist rockets, right? The slings that go like this, it has a V to it, and there's a little thing, a little pouch. You put a pellet or a rock, and it goes through and keeps going, right? The more modern wrist rockets, I used to play with these things. They actually had it so you could hold it here, and you could pull that thing back and run a projectile pretty good. That is not the kind of sling they had back then. The sling they had back then was two ropes or strings, twines, with a pouch, and they would spin it like this, hold it with their two hands very much like chopsticks. You know, if you know how to use chopsticks, you hold one with the one two fingers and the other with the other two fingers. Those of you from Asia know the right way of holding a chopstick. Same thing with a sling, and they could spin that thing around and let go of one of the strings in such trajectory that it could hit something. Now, there are pictures in olden days, ancient days, of slingers hitting birds in flight, of hitting little things 100, 200 feet away. I mean, these guys were good at it. The Israeli army did a study a few years ago to see how fast do these slings go. They go, if you do it right, with a projectile in it, they can go 35 meters a second. 35 meters is approximately 100 feet. That's the distance here in a second. That is about the speed of a 45 caliber pistol. It is going as fast as a pistol, not a gun, rifle, but a pistol, 45, which is pretty fast. That's better than a 22. It's going that fast. And David is the guy who does it. Now, you remember, there's a story of David and the lion. There's a story of David and the bear, right? And it says he struck him, right? Now, I always thought he struck him with a pole or with a stick or with a javelin. He most likely struck him with a sling and with a rock. And interestingly enough, the Romans way back then actually had pliers to pull out stones that were projectiles, stones, from a sling. They actually had pliers to pull out, like pellets, from something that was slung. So here you have David. David's a slinger, but he slings just for the fun of it. He slings for protection from the sheep stealers, the wolves, the lions. These are not African lions. These are mountain lions, more like our Florida panthers. He protects his animals through the sling. Now, David is walking 15 miles from Bethlehem to Elah. Do you know what I think he was doing? This part's not in the Bible. But you know what I think he was doing when he was walking? I think he was doing two things. The two things that it tells us he can do. I bet you he was singing, and I bet you he was flicking his sling. You know, if he had a donkey and he's walking along with all the beasts, you know, all the stuff hanging off this donkey, I bet you he was pulling up rocks and slinging them. As if God was saying, this is the practice I need for this job. Singing, praising the Lord, and slinging a sling. And now we get to the story in the Bible. So turn to verse 38 of chapter 17. David has said, I will go. Saul says, okay. He finally lets in. Then Saul clothed David with his armor. Now, Saul's my size. David's, you know, probably 12 inches shorter, at least. He's putting this armor on him. Now, this armor didn't weigh 125 pounds, but it could have weighed 50 pounds, could have weighed 60 pounds. Can you imagine a boy putting on 60, 70, 80 pounds of armor? He put on a helmet of bronze on his head and clothed him with a coat of mail. Mail is metal. And David strapped his sword over his armor, and he tried in vain to go, for he had not tested them. Then David said to Saul, I cannot go with these, for I have not tested them. David said, forget this. God did not prepare me for the battle with armor. And then it says, so David put them off. And verse 40 is, as we begin the story here, then he took his staff in his hand. Now, a staff is not a javelin. A staff is something you kind of walk with, like a pole. Occasionally, you could push away small animals, push away the brush. But it wasn't an offensive weapon. If anything, it was only a defensive weapon. And chose five smooth stones from the brook and put them in his shepherd's pouch. I only brought three stones. These are all three from a brook in the Valley of Elah. Been there. I've taken people there. We're going to take a group, God willing, in May in there. We have been to the brook. It's now a dry brook in the Valley of Elah. Here are the stones. This is what did it. Now, it was probably a little bigger stone than this. We might have picked, but they were smooth just like this. These are the smaller ones because we could fit them in our suitcases. But they're all across the valley, stones. Now, what's interesting is, and I never picked this up until this week, is that he picked up the stones in the brook in the valley. Now, think about that. He didn't pick up the stones on his way there. He had already shot all those stones. There were no stones in his pouch, I believe, because he's been flicking the stones all day. He's just having a great time flicking those stones. He gets there, and he's up on the hill. He goes to battle without any stones in his pouch. He walks all the way down this hill to this taunting giant who's probably 100 feet away from him right now, and he doesn't even have stones for his sling. Do you get the picture? But yet he still had faith that God was going to deliver him. Let's keep on reading. It's a great story. He put them in his shepherd's pouch. His sling was in his hand, and he approached the Philistine. And the Philistine moved forward and came near to David with his shield bearer in front of him. And when the Philistine looked and saw David, he disdained him, for he was a youth, ruddy and handsome in appearance. And the Philistine said to him, am I a dog that you come to me with sticks? And the Philistine cursed David by his gods. The Philistine said to David, come to me, and I will give your flesh to the birds of the air and to the beasts of the field. Now, let's talk about Goliath for a minute. How was Goliath so big? The people in Israel in that day were very, not small in the sense of dwarf, but they were just average-sized people. Saul was a very tall man. He was 6 foot something, and he was like heads over everybody else. So now you have this giant that probably weighed 500 pounds and was at least 7 foot, maybe 8 foot tall, depending on your translation, how you translate a couple of the Hebrew words. It doesn't really matter, but he's this big, this wide, and this big. Now, there are two main people in the 20th century who have had this disease called giantism, or it's acromegaly, which they believe he had. It's a pituitary gland dysfunction that allows the human growth hormones to continue way past puberty. And so you basically never stop growing, kind of like a tree. There was a man in that was born in 1910 or 12, died in 1940. He was 22 when he died in 1940. Tallest man in modern history, Robert Wadlow. You remember seeing his picture? He was 8 feet 11 inches. If you go to the Guinness Book of World Records, if you have that book, if your kids have it, 8 feet 11 inches. He died at 22, and he was still growing. The one you would recognize more in more modern times is Andre the Giant. Remember him? Did you ever see Princess Bride? The movie Princess Bride. If you haven't seen it, I'm not going to recommend it, but it was funny. He is this giant. Now, he was only 7 foot six, but 550 pounds. There's a story of Andre the Giant. He was out to dinner with Arnold Schwarzenegger one night, and he wanted to pay the meal, and Arnold told the waiter, I'll pay the meal. So they argued over the bill. Schwarzenegger won. Now, Schwarzenegger's a big guy, right? Andre picked him up and carried him one-armed to the car as a joke. He kind of picked him up like this and carried him out of the restaurant. And Schwarzenegger couldn't do anything about it. And they laughed, and it was just a big joke. But that's how big this guy is. And he died in his early 40s because you just can't live too long when you have this disease. There's two side effects to this pituitary gland dysfunction. One is, there's actually three side effects. One is you can't walk fast. If you remember Andre the Giant, he kind of walked like this, which even promotes more the concept of the fear this guy, Goliath, with 165 pounds on, and he's, right? And you think of a giant like this, you think of Jack and the Beanstalk and all the giant there. And part of it is because they cannot run. They cannot walk fast. So there's this deliberate movement like this. And it's a heavy movement, right? Because 200-pound legs dropping down with 165 pounds of mail. It is a heavy thing on these rocks, right? It instills fear. You see that in the movie with Andre the Giant. He's trying to move around that guy, right? And he can't. He's going like this. The other side effect is bad eyesight and many times double vision. It's interesting. He says to him, why have you come with sticks? Now, you'll recall he had one stick, a staff, but Goliath saw two sticks. Why? Because he probably had double vision. So Goliath says, come to me. Come to me. Why did Goliath say, come to me? Because he couldn't see him well, but also because he wanted to do hand-to-hand combat. Hand-to-hand combat. That's what all the guys up here knew, that he wanted hand-to-hand combat. I believe David never intended to do hand-to-hand combat. David never got closer than probably 100 feet away. That's about 35 meters. Let's continue to read the story. Verse 43. And the Philistine said to David, am I a dog that you come to me with sticks? And the Philistine cursed David by his gods. The Philistine said to David, come to me and I will give your flesh to the birds of the air and to the beasts of the field. Then David said to the Philistine, you come to me. This is a great verse, by the way. Verse 45. You come to me with sword and with spear and with javelin. But I come to you in the name of the Lord of the hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defied. This day the Lord will deliver you into my hand, and I will strike you down and cut off your head. Is that amazing? He's 100 feet away. This guy is the biggest guy in known history. Everyone is afraid of him. And he's saying, the Lord is going to deliver you and your head to me. And I will give, this day the Lord will deliver you into my hand, and I will strike you down and cut off your head, and I will give the dead bodies of the hosts of the Philistines this day to the birds of the air and to the wild beasts of the earth, that all the earth may know that there is a God in Israel, and that all this assembly may know that the Lord saves not with sword and spear, for the battle is the Lord's, and he will give you into our hand. The word assembly, that all this assembly are the Israelites. He's referring back to his own people. He's letting them know that you guys are going to die, and I'm going to feed you to the birds, and these guys are going to know, who were afraid, that God is the Lord of hosts, and he will protect them. See, he's doing it for both. He's judging them, but he's also letting them know that they missed it. For the battle is the Lord's, and he will give you into our hand. When the Philistine arose and came and drew near to meet David, David ran quickly toward the battle line to meet the Philistine. This is kind of a review, this paragraph. And David put his hand in his bag and took out a stone and slung it. It goes about 6 or 7 times a second around. We're talking about... This is fast. We're not talking about when you and I play with a sling or kind of throw these kind of things out that we get in the Toys R Us. This guy is a pro at it. He's flicking this thing. The stone sank into his forehead, and he fell on his face to the ground. Have you ever wondered why he fell to his face on the ground? Because this stone is not powerful enough to push a 500-pound person over. But it is powerful enough to penetrate the forehead and to kill him. And at that point, the 165 pounds that he's carrying on the front pulls him down. You ever thought of that? He's now carrying 165 pounds in front of him, right? And he's got a javelin that's 15 pounds. He gets hit here. It's not going to drop him back. It's going to kill him, and he's going to fall forward. It's an amazing thing. It's not like he got stunned, you know, and got thrust back. Like if you hit somebody, you know, in a boxing match and they get stunned, he drops dead down. It is an incredible scene. So David prevailed over the Philistine with a sling and a stone and struck the Philistine and killed him. Now, we don't know if that's a statement kind of describing it, and then he goes into detail, because we really don't know if he died from the stone, he died from the fall. He definitely was dead by the time he got decapitated. So we're not really sure if it killed him or just stunned him. It doesn't matter. It's interesting. Then David ran and stood over the Philistine and took his sword, drew it out. See, he didn't even have a sword. He had nothing. He had a staff, which is to push away sheep that are getting too frisky. And he had a sling with about a 1 pound little stone. Then David ran over and stood over and took his sword and drew it, took the Philistine sword and drew it out of its sheath and killed him and cut off his head with it. It's kind of grotesque. I know it's R-rated. When the Philistines saw that their champion was dead, they fled. And the men of Israel and Judah rose with a shout and pursued the Philistines as far as Gath and the gates of Ekron, so that the wounded Philistines fell on the way from Sharam as far as Gath and Ekron. I mean, they were just killing them all the way down. It was unbelievable. And the people of Israel came back from chasing the Philistines, and they plundered their camp. So they got all the spoils of the Philistines. Now, this is interesting. Verse 54 takes us into the future. This is something, I'll just say it for a moment, and then we'll look at some application. And David took the head of of the Philistine and brought it to Jerusalem, but he put his armor in his tent. He took the head and took it to Jerusalem. Now, you and I know Jerusalem is the head of the state of Israel. Back then, it was not the head of the state of Israel. Back then, it was held by the Jebusites. Jerusalem was in a truce with the Jebusites at this point. And it's interesting, David was able to walk into the city, and he walks in with his head. Now think about it. I got a big head, so my head's this big. So how big is this guy's head? He walks into the city gates. They all know that there was a battle 15 miles to the west. And he goes, here he is, boys, and drops it in front of the elders of the Jebusites. It is a forepicture of what's going to happen when David becomes king and he battles against the Jebusites. He put a little fear of them, actually, if I could say this with respect, fear of God in them. I say that with respect. He drops that head right in front of them. It's a little side story to come when David becomes king and fights against the people from Jerusalem called the Jebusites. And that's the end of the story. You know the story as well as I do. Now, what is the application? And let me tell you, before you run to the normal application, which is underdog beats giant, forget that application. This is not about the underdog beating the giant. Oh, yeah, the underdog did beat the giant, but that's not what this story is about. Can I share a few things which I believe this story is about? And let me, if you want to write these down, I'm going to give you three little settings of things. And we'll end with the looking to the future of this year. David's victory over Goliath gives us an insight into our own contemporary Christian faith. It's an insight. Let me give you the first four things. You don't need to write these down yet, but unless you want to. Number one, the older men were better trained, or not the older men, the men in the army of Israel were better trained, they were older, and they were experienced. Well, that's obvious. David was the least experienced, the least trained, and the youngest of everybody there. What does that tell us? That tells us that God uses everyone. God can use anyone. I am tired of people saying to me, well, God's gifted you, but he hasn't gifted me. I just want to just like, you know, sucker punch you. You know, I say that in all love. But here's the reality. God has gifted you. God has gifted me. God has gifted you. God has gifted me. The fact that I'm a little older, a little more experienced, or there's other people in this room that, you know, these singers, I can't sing like these people. Neither can you. But does that matter? No. All that means is you can't sing as good as these people. So you're not going to stand up here and lead worship, but you are going to do something that God has called you to do. God did not even call him initially to be in the army. And he does what, it's just amazing. Number two. David had divinely guided insights that the others lacked. David had divinely guided insights that the others lacked. Think about his walk from Bethlehem to the Valley of Elah. What was he doing? I believe he was singing, praising, and flicking his sling around. Just the things he needed when he came to a difficult situation. Here's the thing. There was a concept back in those days that there were, and the Philistines believed this, that's why they fought them there, is that everybody had gods. Everybody had gods. See, it said the Philistines prayed to their gods. Everybody had gods. They knew the Israelites had gods. The Israelite gods, so they thought, and I use that word in their language, the gods of the Israelites, there was only one god, they thought they were the gods of the highlands. The Philistines had the gods of the lowlands. They fought them in the lowlands because the gods of the highlands wouldn't come down and protect them in the lowlands. This is how people thought back then. And you think, no, no, no. Well, think of Egypt. They had a god for the sun, Ra. They had a god for the moon. They had a god of the Nile. They had a god of fertility. They had a god of the army. They had a god of women. They had a god of famine. Or of good seasons. They had a god for everything, right? And they felt that the gods were left in Bethlehem, where they worshiped God. And you know what? The Israelites bought into the lie. The Israelites bought into the lie that their God, who is never referenced in this story until David shows up, is still up in the highlands where they worshiped, where the altars were. Isn't that amazing? So many times People come to church, they come to the Bible study, they come to the women's group, they come to the men's group, and they get real excited. And then they go to the office, to the school, to the place of work, to home, and God's not there. You've left God in one place, but let me tell you, God is with you wherever you go. God is with you in the office. God is with you in the classroom. God is with you on the sports field. God is with you. You name the place. But so many times we only worship God in one place. You worship Him here. You worship Him, some of you, in your devotion at home. And you never realize that the worship of the Lord is with you wherever you go. And so when you have need wherever you go, God is with you. We know that, but we don't think of it because we've left God somewhere else. I am here to encourage you to take, and God is everywhere, obviously, but realize that God is with you at all times. And David understood that. He had no, and you know why? Because he's singing his way along the paths while these guys have left their God up in the highlands. Number three, David had faith in God's character. You come with sword and spear, but I come in the name of the Lord our God. David had faith, not in his sling. It's not about the sling and the spear. It's about God and the spear. The sling was just what was used. David had faith in God's character. Do you have faith in God's character? And then finally, David understood that faith is the determining factor from a human standpoint. Faith is the determining factor from the human standpoint. Now think of this. Who did the Israelites see in this story? Who did the Israelites see? They saw Goliath, right? The giant. Who did the Philistines see? They saw an easy foe. They saw victory that was going to come. Sooner or later, someone was going to come down that hill and lose to Goliath. Who did Goliath see? Goliath saw a boy with two sticks. That's who Goliath saw. But who did David see? Who did David see? David saw the Lord. David saw the Lord in this. Now, if some guy like David shows up, says, I'm going to go defeat this man who is now maybe 200 yards, 300 yards away from him. He walks down with a little staff that you could snap, with a sling, with a pouch, with no stones in it. How was he going to do it? He knew he wasn't going to do it. He knew the Lord was going to do it. And he picks up the stones just maybe 100 feet away from the guy and picks up the stones and then does what he knows how to do, and that is to glorify God and to flick a sling. And let me tell you, if you can glorify God and do whatever He's taught you to do, that's all you got to do. Whatever you are good at, do it glorifying God and see what happens. If you're a scientist, be the best scientist glorifying God. If you're a musician, do that. If you're a teacher, do that. If you're a student, do that. If you're a realtor, do that. Whatever you are in this world, in the medical profession, whatever it is, if you're a retiree, be a retiree who glorifies God. Don't be one who's sitting up on the hill saying, well, I'll let the young people do it. Everyone is in this story, right? So let's look at three applications on this. And it's not the underdog beating Goliath. You can apply that one yourself. Three applications. Number one, you have a choice to have hope in God or despair in the current situation. You can hope in God or despair. Those are your two choices. I'm looking across here. I see people who have lost loved ones this year. I've seen people who have had financial reversals, relational reversals, health reversals. I mean, you can name it all. We can despair over it, or we can put our hope in God. If you put your hope in yourself, it's only going to take you so far. And hope in yourself took the Israelites to the battle, but it didn't allow them to take victory in the battle. You can go to the battle. You can get right up to the battle with your own strength, but you are not going to win the battle in your own strength. It is hope in the Lord. Number two, and this is a great one. It's either faith or sight. Faith or sight. David showed faith. We think faith is a New Testament concept. Faith is a concept throughout the entire scriptures. Faith in God versus sight. And what's interesting is, here's the beautiful thing to think about it. The giant had no sight. We think these giants in the world are so powerful because they're so big. And we realize that he couldn't do anything unless you got right up to him and allowed you, you know, to embrace. And then he would have killed him, no doubt about it. He was certainly had the arm strength beyond that. Now, here's a question. Who is the most qualified person on the entire battlefield to fight Goliath? There was only one. The projectile warrior. He was the only one who could beat Goliath. The projectile warrior. There was one slinger in the whole group. He was the only one who could beat him. And God brought him there providentially. He was ready to take on the battle, and he did it. God brings you to a place that allows you, by faith, to take on the battle. And he gives you the ability to do it. It is not someone else's job, because someone else can't do that. I remember when Elizabeth and I had our tragedy 8 years ago, when our son died 7.5 years ago, people looked at us as we were working and grieving and going through it, and they kept saying, we couldn't do what you're doing. And after I got through some of my grieving, I looked at them and I said, you're right, you can't do what we're doing. Because God's grace came to us for the needs that we had to get through our battles. God didn't give you the grace to fight my battles. God gives you the grace to live through your battles, through your life. He doesn't give it to me. He gives it to you. And that's why people come up to me and say, hey, would you fight my battle for me? God didn't give me the grace to fight your battle. God gave me the ability to encourage you. God gave me the ability to pray with you. But God has given you the ability to fight through, to work through your battles. If you work by faith, because if you work by sight, you will fail. You'll stay up on the mountain and you will not come down. And there will be this friction that will occur. And then finally, third, courage versus fear. The Bible says God has not given us a spirit of fear, but of love and of power and a sound mind. Have you ever lived in fear? I have. It is brutal. If you choose to live in fear, you will be immobilized. Like the children of Israel were immobilized. There's nothing they could do. The strength of Saul, the strength of Eliab, and the promise of riches, no taxes, and this beautiful woman to be your wife was not even enough to ungrip the fear to take these people to go down and fight the battle. It's only by faith. It's only with courage. And if you look through the Bible, it is the courageous that succeed. Not because they're doing it through sight or through might. And we'll find David doing a few of those sight and might things and why he falls when he does. But it's through faith and through hope in God. Amen? Let's pause and pray. I want you to think as we're moving into 2014... do you live in hope or despair? Do you live in faith or by sight? Do you live in courage or with courage or in fear? The choice is yours. It's a simple thing. There's nothing here that's hard. It's a simple story. But do not lose the story of just an underdog beating a giant. It's the Lord who beat the giant. We are on the Lord's side. We put a period, paragraph, close the chapter on 2013 in a day and a half. And we move to 2014. Maybe you live in hope and you live in courage and you live in faith. Continue to do it. as David, sing the song of praises, keep flicking that sling around. But maybe you live in fear and despondency, and you're living by sight, and you're seeing the giants in front of you. I enjoy praying with many of you one-on-one and two-on-one and families who are in great need. And I just always pray that you live by faith as you go through the difficulties of this life, health difficulties some of you are going through right now, loss. You'll never get that person back. They've died. How can you live in hope? Only through faith and not by sight. Today's invitation is for each of us. It's not for one person or two. It's for every person in this room. I invite you to pray right now and ask the Lord to help you, to be with you as we enter into this new year. Just take a moment, just privately. Do that. Look up here for a moment, and then I'm going to pray. It's not about the stones. He didn't even have the stones in his pocket when he said yes to the Lord. He had the Word of God, the character of God, the belief in God in his life. That's what sustained him. Then he picked up the stones to sling them. It is not about slinging stones at the giants. It's about coming in the name of the Lord our God. Let's all stand and pray, and then we're going to close in a chorus. I wish you a happy and meaningful new year. I pray that 2014 is the best year in your life. For those of you that are older, that are at the end of your life, that this is a great ending. Some of you may not come into 2015, but that you end it well. For those who are just at the beginning of their life, the children and young people, that you move through this year well. For those of us in our middle ages, married and single, divorced, having lost our spouses, that we move forward. And Father, I pray a blessing on this congregation. I pray that you would guide each of us, that your Spirit would be upon us, that we would not live our lives just flicking stones, but we would live them in the name of the Lord our God, who is you. And I thank you for that. I pray a blessing on each person in this room. In the name of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. And everyone said, amen. Let's sing a chorus and then we'll...